In Northwest News on KPLU, in the last 5 years, more than 14,000 construction permits have been issued by the city of Seattle. A new seawall is being built along the waterfront, as well as a tunnel for traffic. But what's going on today is nothing compared to what was happening here in the late 1800s. What Seattle looked like when the first white settlers arrived and how they transformed the landscape is explored in a new book. It's called Too High and Too Steep, and I caught up with the author, David Williams. Seattle began on an island. I'll explain in just a minute. David Williams, the author of Too High and Too Steep, Reshaping Seattle's Topography, says just south of First and Cherry in Seattle's Pioneer Square neighborhood,
about a block and a half, you would go up a slight mound, and behind that mound would have been a tidal lagoon, so water would flow in and flow out.
Where First and Yesler is today, there was a low point that the early settlers called the sag. At high tide, water could come in and flow across the sag. So that little mound actually became
an island. So in a way, Seattle was settled on an island. You think about that, like, what a crazy place to begin a city.
It was all of this water that drew the first settlers here. They knew that the bay was deep and saw its potential as a major port, a place where the 1,500-year-old trees dotting the hills could be cut down and loaded onto ships headed for San Francisco. But the land, well, that needed to change.
The story goes is that the first industry in Seattle, Henry Yesler's sawmill, a guy named Dutch Ned, literally took a wheelbarrow and would take that wheelbarrow and dump sawdust into that low point, the sag, and into the swamp that was behind it. So that area actually becomes known as the sawdust.
Wheelbarrow after wheelbarrow gets dumped into the water. This continues for decades.
As they continuously would build a pier out into the water and then dump debris around it to build up the land.
And there was no opposition to this.
The people here know that they have to create flat land somewhere, and the tide flats is the logical place. They needed that land for industry.
In 1895, a guy named Eugene Semple comes to town.
Semple was the next to last territorial governor of Washington Territory, tries to become the first governor of the state in 1889. He loses. He moves to Seattle. And Semple's the one who is the driver
behind turning 2,500 acres of eelgrass and mud between Beacon Hill and West Seattle into dry land. Semple used two dredge boats called the Anaconda and the Python to suck up debris and then dump it all over a wall.
The tide flats was never, even at high tide, was only about 10 or 15 feet deep. So when the tide's out, all you have to do really is build a wall 10 or 12 feet high, is high enough to then dump all this sediment behind. But it what's incredible to think is it was one person who really drove that process. There was no vote that said, oh, we should do this. There weren't any referendums, initiatives, any of the thing that we think of that goes on now to make anything happen. He just decided to do it.
Filling in tide flats and reworking waterways. These were things other cities were doing. In the 1600s, Boston filled in 5,000 acres of swampy land. What set Seattle apart was flattening the hills that were carved out by glaciers 14,000 years ago, redoing or regrading Mother Nature's work. The man behind this was
Reginald Heber Thompson.
Thompson was a failed mining engineer from Indiana who decided to try his luck out west.
Thompson had this belief that a city was like a human body in the sense that it needed to have good arteries. So a human body has blood flowing through it. A city needed to have good arteries for allow communication and traffic to move through the city. The line is that Seattle was in a pit and we needed to get out of it.
So when did this process start?
In 1898, he gets his first chance to regrade Denny Hill, which he had always believed was the main obstacle in the city. And the reason he believed that is the business district of Seattle originally started down by Pioneer Square, and it's slowly moving north.
But as you headed north, there were steep hills that got in the way.
You get rid of that obstacle, and the line was that business would flow unhampered into its natural channels. So that was what the driver was.
Seattle's hills are made of compacted dirt and clay, material that can easily be washed away by water.
And what you do is you start with water in a big tube until it comes out of basically a big hose with a 4 or 5 inch opening at what they describe as the rate of a cannon, and it could blast away our hills. And if you have a problem, throw some dynamite in, blow up what's in the way, and keep moving. And they did that regularly.
And it's not as though there were trees and meadows and undeveloped land at the tops of these hills. There were communities on them.
I know that when I started doing research on this, I didn't realize that. I sort of had this image like, oh, Denny Hill's there, and it's maybe a forested landscape. But then you start looking, and there were 300-400 houses up there. There were there were schools. There was a church or three up there. There was the best-known hotel in the city on Denny Hill. There were a huge number of people whose lives were completely changed.
And Thompson was able to convince all these people?
Thompson was able to convince all of them.
In fact, it was the property owners who paid for their land to be leveled by water and dynamite. Most of the people who lived there had no intention of staying. The hope was once their plot was lowered 20 feet, 30 feet, in some cases 100 feet, it would become more valuable and they'd sell it to developers. Williams says these projects were epic in comparison to the changes that are happening in Seattle today. He says Denny Hill was able to be washed away because back then, our history was so young. There wasn't enough time to be sentimental.
Most everyone who lived on the hill was first generation on the hill. So it wasn't like we were going to be destroying your great-great-great-grandmother's house. You're destroying houses that were only built 20, 30 years ago. That was their viewpoint.
Where can we go to see parts of Seattle as it was? Would Discovery Park be an equivalent of that today?
Exactly. Discovery Park is what it would have looked like. So a steep bluff, probably some trees growing on it, probably some landslides on it. At low tide, the shoreline would extend much further, but primarily the tide didn't always get that low. And so you would see this, you would generally see water there.
Okay, so if you get in a boat and you're in the Sound, looking up at those bluffs at Discovery Park, you can say, wow, this is what the waterfront of downtown Seattle looked like. And the people at that time thought, let's dig in.
Crazy.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's David Williams, the author of Too High and Too Steep, Reshaping Seattle's Topography. I'm Jennifer Wing. KPLU News.